Okay, so welcome everyone, and surprise, surprise, Mahapanibbana Sutta. So one of these years, for some of us, one of these lifetimes, we're going to finish the sutta, but for now we'll just see what happens in the meantime. So we have seen how the Buddha has spent his last rains retreat in Vesali being the capital of the Vajrayana kingdom, the Vajrayana Republic, I should say, one of the ancient republics in India, which had a bit like a democracy, was ruled by a kind of democratic rule. Not fully democratic, it was only kind of the elite that had democracy, a bit like ancient Greece. The ordinary people didn't really take part in that democracy. So he has just left there, and this is what happens after he leaves there, and he goes to a place called the Bandagama. This is the next little town where the next events happen. And it's interesting, as I think I mentioned this last time, the closer we get to the Buddha's passing away, the more events are kind of packed into each day, as if they kind of are afraid of losing the Buddha. So they kind of add more and more every day. The closer you get to the time, the more information we have about what happened to the Buddha. Some of it is probably historical, because there seems to be no reason why it shouldn't have happened roughly this way. But some of it is clearly also mythological. So the Mahapanibbana Sutta is like a mixture of myth and history, and then combined, of course, with a lot of teachings, Dhamma material in there at the same time. But a lot of the material is mythological. And we will see this when we come closer to the Buddha's final passing away. The closer we come to the very end, the more kind of miraculous and supernormal events happen. Interesting, of course, as often those miraculous and supernormal events, they turn out to be a little bit dodgy. And the reason we know that they're dodgy is because they occur only in some versions of this sutta, do not occur in other versions of it. So, for example, you read some of the versions of the other schools of early Buddhism, the Sarvastivadin version, Dharmaguptaka, they may not have that supernormal story, whereas all the other events are exactly the same. So in this way, you can kind of filter out what would be considered more historical events and what are more kind of added mythological, legendary events, which are quite likely not literally true, but were more a kind of the Buddhist community trying to elevate the Buddha and lift him up and make him into something special after he passed away. Because this sutta was obviously put together after the Buddha passed away, because it includes events that came after his passing away. So now we have come to paragraph 4.4, section 4, paragraph 4, whatever you want to call it. This is what happens. And again, we're using Morris Walsh's translation, although I must admit I quite like Ajahn Sujato's translation recently. It's very kind of, has a lot of colloquialisms and things in it, which makes it really kind of, you really feel that you are almost like in the presence of the Buddha, because the language is so contemporary here. It's like no worries, that kind of stuff in there. Well, actually, I don't think he uses no worries, because it's a little bit too Australian, but that kind of thing, which is very universal. And when you read it, you get this feeling that the Buddha is right there, because the language he uses is just like we would talk to each other, yeah? And that's really strange how that actually makes the Buddha come closer to you when you have that kind of language. When you have this sort of very formal language, and the language that, you know, sometimes some of the translators, they are maybe too intellectual, you know, and too kind of, you know, big body, he's kind of super duper intelligent, a PhD in philosophy, and when you read the translation, you get that feeling of something being quite elevated, but that creates a distance between you and the Buddha. But if the language is more natural, it is almost as if, you know, you can almost feel that you are having a conversation or communication together. That makes a massive difference. It actually makes a feeling that he actually could be talking to you, which is really, really nice. So anyway, so this is Maurice Walsh's translation, which is not bad in terms of the language being quite accessible, which is great. So this is what happens next. Then the Lord, in other words, the Buddha, was staying at Bandagama, and he delivered a, not comprehensive, he delivered many discourses. This is morality, this is stillness, this is wisdom. Stillness, when imbued with morality, brings great fruit and great profit or benefit. Wisdom, when imbued with stillness, brings great fruit and great profit. The mind imbued with wisdom becomes completely freed from the corruptions, that is, the corruption of sensuality, the corruption of craving for existence. You can see I retranslate a little bit because I prefer alternative translations. The corruption of ignorance, or avidya, or delusion, if you like. The false views, you can pretty much cross it out. I think it's a mistake in there. And again, this is one of these little teachings that we see throughout the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. Every little town or village the Buddha comes to, and these are little villages, Bandagama. Gama means village. So this is little the Banda village. And Banda means goods, so this is a village full of goods or something like that. Not sure what that means, but maybe they were very materialistic. Maybe it's the materialistic village, the Bandagama. I don't know. I'm just guessing, just kind of making it up. But so every village he comes to, he gives a teaching, obviously, because they want to inspire the inhabitants and wants to kind of, you know, this is the last time they have a chance to see the Buddha, etc. And this is the teaching he gives all the way through. So this teaching then is really a summary of what the Buddhist teaching is about. And of course here, it is a summary of the path. So you have morality, you have stillness, which is samadhi, of course, and then you have wisdom. And of course these three, they are just an alternative way of looking at the Noble Eightfold Path. So you have these three, and then you have this beautiful idea of the causality that is involved in this. When samadhi, stillness, is imbued with morality, then it is powerful, then it is great fruit and great profit, great benefit. And this is such an important teaching, and because here it summarizes the entire Dhamma, the entire path of what the Buddha was talking about. You can take it, this is absolutely central for what, you know, for how we practice this path. So if you feel that your stillness isn't that profound, why is that the case? Well, because the morality hasn't really been purified enough yet. And of course here it is so important to remember that the idea of morality in Buddhism is so broad. It includes how we think about things, how we perceive things, and all of this is part of that. So this really gives you a very good idea of how you should go about your practice right there. And that is really sufficient as a kind of shorthand for the entire path of Buddhism. And then, of course, the very important point that stillness imbues wisdom. So without that samadhi, again, wisdom doesn't really become all that powerful and profitable and fruitful. But with stillness, that's when it becomes powerful. And then, when the mind is imbued with wisdom, sounds good, doesn't it? Mind imbued with wisdom. Wisdom is like the best, in my reckoning. I reckon wisdom is it really sounds, who doesn't want to be wiser? When that happens, then the corruptions, these are the asavas, these are the very most fundamental distortions or defilements of the mind. And these are the things that ultimately keep you being reborn and keep you suffering. These are ultimately, in one way, these are the cause of suffering. The corruption of sensuality, in other words, the attraction to sensual pleasures, the attraction to existence. If you want to exist, you have a problem. What do you think about that? It's pretty radical, isn't it? This is Buddhism for you. If you still have this really strong desire to exist, then actually that is called a corruption in Buddhism. This is why Buddhism is kind of hard to grasp sometimes. So if that doesn't make any sense to you, I don't know, is anyone here who is new to hearing suttas and the word of the Buddha? Or are you all old hands at suttas? You're quite new? Okay. So for those of you who are quite new, when you hear this kind of thing, say, okay, whoa, this is scary, put it a bit on the back burner, don't worry too much about it, and go with the things that you kind of make sense to you. Because there's a lot to be learned just by kind of doing the more kind of, I shouldn't say simple, because that kind of is putting it down a bit. The more basic, perhaps, the more preliminary teachings take you a long way, and these more profound things takes a while before that starts to make sense, because it has to only really make sense in the context of the other teachings. That's when it starts to kind of, okay, now I understand what it's about. But this already shows you some of the profundity of what is happening in the Buddhist teaching here. And then last, we have the asava, or the corruption of ignorance or delusion. Avidya is the Pali word. And it kind of makes sense, yeah? If we are ignorant or we are deluded about reality, obviously that's going to be a problem. Huh? So that is the root problem of everything else. So very beautiful teaching, and I have mentioned it many times already because it has come up regularly while we have been doing the sutta over the last couple of years, or whatever it is, last year and a half or whatever. I was joking when I started out, oh, we're going to finish this by 2022 or something. I was joking. It turns out I was right, probably. Everybody was laughing. That was the... Anyway, if I don't stop saying such things, we'll go for even longer here. So, then when the Lord had stayed at Bandagama for as long as he wished, he said, Ananda, let us go to Hatigama, to Ambagama, to Jambugama, and giving the same discourse, the same kind of summary of the Dhamma in every place. Then he said, Ananda, let us go to Boganagara. So these are all little villages. You see the Gama at the end means it's a village. And these have all very earthy names. Hatigama is elephant village, Ambagama is mango village, and Jambugama is rose apple village. And Boga Nagara, again, Boga means like possessions. So this is the Nagara is city. This is the city of possessions. So they kind of, I guess, just like modern names, they all have a meaning here to them. Here. So, very good Lord, said Ananda, and the Lord went with a large company of monks to Boga Nagara. At Boga Nagara, the Lord stayed at the Ananda shrine. Here. And there he said to the monks, Monks, I will teach you the four criteria, also called the four great standards. Listen, pay close attention, and I will speak. Yes, Lord, replied the monks. And here we come to a quite an important teaching. And this is only really occurs in this sutta, and you will see very soon why it belongs here. Because this is the teaching about how to accumulate or to collect the teachings of the Buddha after he has passed away. Because the problem with the Buddha's teaching is that they would have been spread over a very large area to a large number of people. The Buddha traveled around the Ganges plain. He gave teachings to various groups, to monks, to nuns, to lay people, and everything. And because of that, the teaching would have been spread out, and different teachers would have heard different teachings. Different disciples would have heard different teachings. So then, how do we collect all of these teachings together to make a Buddhist canon, if you like, of all the important suttas of the Buddha? And this is what this is about. So it's very interesting, and it's actually very applicable to the present day, how we approach the suttas in the present day as well. This is why it is so interesting here. It's surprising how liberal it was in those days, how kind of free people were to look at the Buddha's teachings as they saw fit. There's a very interesting little anecdote, and this is found in the Vinayapitaka, and this is part of what happened after the Buddha had passed away, and we had the first council, which is the first communal recitation where all the monks came together, and they were to chant or to recite the Buddha's teachings, and then to pass it on as a kind of collection to posterity, to future generations of disciples, etc. And very interesting, at that council, just after the council is finished, Venerable Ananda, who is here the Buddha's disciple, he then recited all the suttas, because he had been present over last 20 years of the Buddha's lifetime hearing suttas, and he had a phenomenal memory according to what we know from the suttas. Just after this recitation, this other monk arrives, and he arrives too late. His name was it Gavampati? No, Purana or something like that was his name. And he says to the monks, oh, very good that you have recited the suttas, well done, but I will remember the suttas as I heard them. Yeah? And that was fine. That was no problem. Yeah, it wasn't as if, well, he had to kind of toe the party line and listen to the suttas according to what the 500 arahants had recited. It gives a lot of authority to the suttas when 500 arahants, fully enlightened beings, have recited them together. But no, he rejected that. I will remember the word of the Buddha as he gave it to me. That's what he said. And that's kind of nice, as long as we have that openness and we have that kind of ability to go beyond having two fixed views about things. If something is reasonable, then it is the word of the Buddha. And this here explains to us how we know whether something is reasonable or not, how we can conclude that it must have been the word of the Buddha. Of course, those monks at that time would have been in a very special position because they had received the teaching from the Buddha himself. So it was kind of okay, there wasn't much doubt. But for us, it's a bit more tricky. But we'll see how we negotiate this. So here is the Buddha saying to the monks, listen, pay close attention, I will speak. Yeah, so he's going to say something important, presumably. Yeah. And he says, suppose a monk were to say, friends, I heard and received this from the Lord's own lips. This is the Dhamma, this is the training, this is the master's teaching. Yeah. Then, monks, you should neither approve nor disapprove his words. And then without approving or disapproving, his words and expressions should be carefully noted and compared with the suttas and reviewed in light of the training, the discipline, the vinaya. Here it probably means the vinaya pitaka, actually. Yeah, so you take, if someone says you heard something of Buddha, you compare it to what you already have. If they, on such comparison and review, are found not to conform to the suttas or the vinaya, the conclusion must be, assuredly, this is not the word of the Buddha. It has been wrongly understood by this monk, and the matter is to be rejected. Not the matter, in other words, that teaching, yeah, whatever he thinks it is, that has to be rejected. That's really what it means. But where on such comparison and review they are found to conform to the suttas and the vinaya, the conclusion must be, assuredly, this is the word of the Buddha. It has been rightly understood by this monk. This is the first criterion. So here we have a time when it seems as if the Buddha has already passed away. Yeah? Someone is saying, I have received this from the Lord's own lips. It sounds like the Buddha is no longer there, because otherwise you would have gone to the Buddha and said, well, let's check with the Buddha whether you're right or not. So it seems here that we are already envisaging a time after the Buddha passed away. So this is probably the Buddha looking into the future. Or maybe this was something that was, possibly it was made up after the Buddha. I doubt it, because it is here put into the mouth of the Buddha and it is found across all the various recensions. So probably it was spoken by the Buddha himself. So it is already, you're envisaging a time after the Buddha passed away. So what do we do then when all these monks come in and say, oh, I have a teaching, you've got to collect this one, yeah? You've got to put it together with all the other ones. This is what you do. You compare it to what you already have. So what are those teachings that you already have? And if you think back, I don't know, for those of you who were here before, the Buddha talks earlier on about what his teachings are. In one place it talks about the Four Noble Truths, which are like the container for all the other teachings, which is like the kind of big container. In another place it talks about the 37 aids to awakening, the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, which are all the factors that have to do with the actual practice. 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, this is one way of looking at it. And at other places he just says the Dhamma Vinaya that I have taught you. So already there are obviously a number of suttas that have been remembered by the monks and the nuns and the lay people over a long period of time that have been collected that are about these particular subject matters. And that is the essence against which you compare new suttas. And then you decide whether the new sutta that someone has heard is worthy of being collected in this way. And then you build up the Sutta Pitaka, yeah? And this is why the suttas were built up over quite a long period of time after the Buddha passed away, because there would have been additions coming in, yeah? People would have come and said, oh, I remember one sutta, oh, don't forget this one. And even the lay people had suttas they remembered, yeah? There is a little paragraph in the Vinaya Pitaka. There is an allowance for the monastics to take 7-day leave during the rainy season. Usually during the rainy season you're supposed to stay in one place, but under special circumstances you can actually take 7-day leave. And one of those circumstances is if a layperson says, oh, I know this sutta, please come and learn it before it disappears. Yeah, so even that would have been kind of relevant. And of course many of the suttas, especially in the Anguttara Nikaya, are of course spoken to lay people, so they would have been the ones who collected those and then carry them forward somehow from there. And this teaching is also very useful in the present day, because now we are in very much in exactly the same position. Yeah, for example, you may go to the Abhidhamma Pitaka, and in the and it is said in the commentaries that it was taught by the Buddha. It doesn't actually say that in the Abhidhamma Pitaka itself, but it says in the commentaries. You go to the Mahayana Suttas. The Mahayana Suttas often start out with the Buddha was staying on Mount Vulture Peak, yeah, the famous place in Rajagaha. He was staying on Mount Vulture Peak with 1,000 or 1,000,000 bodhisattvas. And while he was there, he taught such and such a sutta. So are they sounds like they come from the Buddha, yeah, it sounds like they might be from the mouth of the Buddha, the way they are presented, but is it really the case? This is how you find out. What do you compare it to? You compare it to the earliest part of the Buddha's teachings, which is what I mentioned before, which are essentially the four Nikayas, the four collections, long discourses, middle-length discourses, numerical, and connected discourses, yeah, which are really the collections that collect these things I was talking about before, the 37 Age to Awakening, the Four Noble Truths, and all of that. So it is actually very useful now, and we can use this then to eliminate many things as not being the word of the Buddha, because it doesn't really fit in properly. It is more elaborated on it. It takes things further. The Abhidhamma is a step further from the suttas. The Mahayana suttas often have very new ideas added to them. The commentaries add new things. Yeah, even within the Sutta Pitaka itself, you can sometimes see that some of the suttas may not be as authentic as others. Like, for example, one-off suttas that have a strange theme, or things that suttas that use a different vocabulary from the other suttas that look more like the Abhidhamma or whatever. And then you can kind of contract it down to what is the essence of these Buddhist teachings. Basically, if you read the long discourses of the Buddha, these are, by the way, this is the long discourses, if you don't know, number 16, the middle-length discourses, the connected discourses, and the numerical discourses, then basically that is roughly where you are, where you find these teachings. So very useful little rule of thumb, and this goes all the way back to the Buddha. So this is what we also need to use in the present day. And of course, not only does it go for scriptures, it also goes for modern teachers, contemporary teachers. Who is telling the truth? Who thinks they're telling the truth, but not actually telling the truth? What about me? Am I just messing around? Am I just, you know, how do you know that this is what I'm saying makes any sense at all? You don't really, especially if you're new. Yeah, you haven't got a clue. Maybe I'm just telling you tall stories all the way through. It's possible. You just don't know. Yeah, you're starting off. Okay, so you have a bit of trust when you come in here initially, and it all sounds good and that kind of thing. But in the end, everyone, even when you try your very best to deliver the Dhamma to the best of your ability, you probably have your own delusions. You have your own misunderstandings. And then it's very handy to go back to the gold standard of Buddhism, which is the suttas. Anyway, that is the first criterion. And the next three criteria are pretty much exactly the same. It's just that we're talking about different groups of people. Suppose a monk were to say, in such and such a place there is a community with elders and distinguished teachers. I have heard and received this from that community. Then, monks, you should neither approve nor disapprove his words. Then, without approving or disapproving his words, an expression should be carefully noted and compared with the suttas and reviewed in light of the Vinaya. If they on such comparison and review are found not to conform to the suttas or the Vinaya, the conclusion must be, assuredly, this is not the word of the Buddha. It has been wrongly understood by this monk, and that teaching should be rejected. But where on such comparison and review they are found to conform to the suttas, or the Vinaya, the conclusion must be, assuredly, this is the word of the Buddha. It has been rightly understood by this monk. This is the second criterion. Third, suppose a monk were to say, in such and such a place, there are many elders who are learned, bearers of the tradition, who know the Dhamma, the discipline, the code of rules, etc., etc. Exactly the same thing as before. This is the third criterion. Four, suppose a monk were to say, in such and such a place, there is one elder who is learned, the bearer or the master of the tradition, who knows the Dhamma and the discipline and the code of rules. I have heard and received from that elder, but then on such comparison and review, they are found not to conform to the suttas or the Vinaya, then the conclusion must be, assuredly, they are the word of the Buddha, conforms it, assuredly this is the word of the Buddha. It has been rightly understood by this monk. So just four different groups of people, really the same, exactly the same kind of, the same criterion used throughout, and you compare. In all of these cases, you will notice that the sutta, it comes from someone who is learned. Yeah, these are kind of important word. Learned, the bearer of the tradition. This is like the agama dara. Agatagama, I haven't got the Pali here. Something like that. The one who has received the tradition from others. The word agama was that. And then someone who is the master of the Dhamma. This is like the Dhamma Dara, the Vinaya Dara. So these are people who are learned, yeah, ideally, who are also very respected for their practice at the same time. That is when this becomes very much more useful as suttas. So there you are. That is the four great criteria, and they are still very much useful even in the present day. So useful to know about. Everyone happy with the four criteria? That makes sense to everyone? Huh? Yeah? Okay. Please feel free to ask as we go along. So then we can carry on. Then the Lord, while staying at Bhoganagara, delivered again many discourses. This is morality, this is stillness, as before, this is wisdom, etc. Then, when the Lord had stayed at Bhoganagara for as long as he wished, he said to Ananda, "Let us go to Pava." "Very good, Lord," said Ananda, and the Lord went with a large company of monks to Pava, where he stayed in the mango grove of Chunda the smith. Now we are getting very close to the Buddha's passing away. Pava is the little town before Kushinara. Kushinara is the next one that comes after Pava. And Pava and Kushinara, they were the two capitals, if you like, very small capitals of the two republics, the two Malan republics. And Pava, quite interestingly, is the place where the Mahavira is supposed to have passed away. Mahavira, who was one of the early leaders of the Jain ascetics, the Jain sect. And the Jains were usually considered to be a slightly older teaching, an older religion than the Buddhists. And they actually had some leaders that existed before the Buddha. And the Mahavira, or the Nigantha Nataputta, as he is known in the suttas, in the Buddha suttas, he passed away shortly before the Buddha, and he passed away precisely at Pava. That's where he died. And there is a sutta about that, how the Jains, after the Nigantha Nataputta passed away, how they were arguing with each other and, you know, kind of splitting from each other. Because as you often would expect, when the leader dies in a religion, then you start arguing afterwards and you get all the subsects and subgroups. This is kind of the standard thing here. I don't know if, I guess maybe the point there was that to make a kind of a warning to the Buddhist not to fall into the same trap, perhaps, when the Buddha was about to pass away, not so long afterwards. I also wonder sometimes whether there's a bit of kind of Buddhist propaganda in there. Yeah, when the other sects, when they leader die, then if they all kind of fall into problems and they argue with each other, and kind of it's almost a bit like you. It's almost like a bit of Buddhist kind of we are better than that kind of thing almost. And maybe that is required. Maybe you need that, because maybe you need that to, as a warning to your own sake. Maybe that's how it should be used. Anyway, sometimes the viewpoint of the suttas is a Buddhist viewpoint. It's important to remember that. So it may not be entirely objective sometimes. We see things from a Buddhist point of view. The people who put together these suttas are not always arahants. They were not always 100% objective. Sometimes they maybe have added little things that were kind of sounded right. And for that reason, we need to be a little bit circumspect when we read these things. Anyway, that's Pava. So Pava is the Eastern Malan Republic, just before the Buddha arrives at Kushinara. And here he stayed in the mango grove of Chunda the smith. So wherever the Buddha goes, he has disciples. And Chunda heard that the Lord had arrived at Pava and was staying at his mango grove. So he went to the Lord, saluted him, or if you like, bowed down to him, and sat down to one side. And the Lord instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted him with a talk on Dhamma. Then Chunda said, "May the Lord accept a meal from me tomorrow with his order of monks." And the Lord consented by silence. And Chunda, understanding his consent, rose from his seat, bowed down to the Lord, and circumambulating him with the right side towards him, he departed. And as the night was coming to an end, Chunda had all kind of fine food. Hard and soft does not really make any sense, so forget about that. All kind of fine food prepared with an abundance of pig's delight, Sukara Madhava. This is the... we'll see more of that later on. And when it was ready, he reported to the Lord, "Lord, the meal is ready." Then the Lord, having dressed in the morning, or having robed up in the morning, took his bowl and robe and went with his order of monks to Chunda's dwelling, where he sat down on the prepared seat and said, "Serve the pig's delight that has been prepared to me, and serve the remaining food to the order of monks." "Very good, Lord," said Chunda, and did so. This is kind of strange. It's like the Buddha can see something going on here. And of course, if you have read the sutta before, you know what that is. So why does it say that? And we will see in a second, it looks like the Buddha knows something about the food. I will talk a bit more about this afterwards, because it's a little bit strange. Here already we're seeing the supernormal powers kind of creeping into the text. Then the Lord said to Chunda, "Whatever is left over of the pig's delight, you should bury it in the pit." "Because, Chunda, I can see no one in this world with his devas, maras, and brahmas, in this generation with his ascetics and brahmins, its princes and people, who, if they were to eat it, could thoroughly digest it, except for the Buddha, the Tathagata." "Very good, Lord," said Chunda, and having buried the remains of the pig's delight in the pit, he came to the Lord, saluted him, and sat down to one side. Then the Lord, having instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted him with a talk on Dhamma, rose from his seat and departed. And after having eaten the meal provided by Chunda, the Lord was attacked by a severe sickness with bloody diarrhea and with sharp pains, as if he were about to die. But he endured all this mindfully and clearly aware, without being worried about it, if you like, without being oppressed by it. Then the Lord said to Ananda, "Let us go to Kushinara." "Very good, Lord," said Ananda. So here we have this very famous story of the Buddha's last meal. Yeah, this is the last meal. Now we're seeing kind of the last thing starting to happen, the last meal in the Buddha's career, the last village that he's visiting, the last this, the last that. So we're coming very close to the end. And this is the very famous Last Meal. And from what you read here, and from what we see also later on here, it looks like this was what actually made the Buddha pass away later on. Obviously, he's getting very ill here. This would have been some very poisonous food. So it looks like this would have killed him. Yeah, except that the problem is that we already know that the Buddha almost died during the rains retreat before, as we saw that earlier on in the same sutta. He already died from old age, almost, and he had to use his energy and had to use his special powers to kind of be able to at least remain a little bit longer. So old age is already a kind of a big contender here for being the cause of death. Then we have the other one where he relinquishes the life faculty when in the presence of Mara, yeah, as a second kind of reason for the Buddha to die. Third one is the meal that he's eating here. So what did he die from? Did all of these? One of them? Two? None of them? Something else entirely? It gets very confusing after a while. What actually did the Buddha die from? And to be able to ascertain these kind of things, first of all, it actually does matter a little bit, because it does matter how we relate to the Buddha as a person, how he died. If he died in a supernormal way, whereby he kind of relinquished the life faculty in the presence of Mara, which is all very supernatural, then it's kind of strange, very hard to relate to her. On the other hand, if he just died from old age, well, then that's kind of what you would expect. If you have a physical body, yeah, that's what you would expect from a physical body. It can only last so long. Yeah. That is kind of a natural explanation. And I have already kind of rejected the explanation of giving up the life faculty in the presence of Mara. We kind of looked that up before, and it was very strange in many ways. And I don't think that is what really happened. I think that is a later explanation that was used because it was felt to be required to make sense of the Buddha's passing away. So what about this one here? And again, the way to find out whether this is maybe true or not, one way to start with that is to look at other versions of this sutta. And I mentioned before, there is a Sarvastivadin version, the Sarvastivadin school in Sanskrit. Yeah, so you can compare with that one. There are a few versions in Chinese, only one translated into English. I can't read Chinese, unfortunately. I wish I could, but I can't. So we have at least three versions. And all of those versions are quite different. Yeah, in the Sanskrit version, there is no Sukara Madhava. The Buddha doesn't get sick. There is no bad food. He just goes to have the last meal there. And then after having the last meal there, then there's something else happens, and the Buddha carries on. Yeah, so that version doesn't even have that. So from that version, it falls back to the idea of just dying from old age. And this, I think, to me, is then my preferred explanation, because here, this is kind of full of various kind of slightly supernormal things. The Buddha knows that the food is bad already. How do you know that? Does he kind of check out every time he eats whether the food is bad? Or even if he could know it, why would he check it out? Is that what he does regularly? Is he paranoid about being killed? It's kind of strange, isn't it, when you think about it? And so to me, all of this, and in another version of the sutta, when the food is put into the pit, into the ground, it hisses, yeah, and smoke coming out of the food would have been really bad. Have you ever seen food that is so bad that it starts to hiss and smoke when you pour it out? Is that possible? Does that happen with food? It would be really, really extraordinarily bad. Maybe if there was some nuclear contamination or something, I don't know. But it seems over the top. So in this case, again, I prefer the simplest version, the version that is kind of the most natural one, naturalistic one. That is the one I prefer. And that is the version where Buddha simply is old. He is described in other suttas as, you know, his body, he's getting stooped over, and his, you know, skin is kind of getting wrinkled, and his faculties are not as clear as they were before, like it happens with everyone. Your eyesight is deteriorating, your hearing is deteriorating as you get towards the end of your life. That is actually described in other suttas. And so clearly the Buddha was getting old, just like everyone else. And that seems to be also, to me, the message coming from this particular sutta. Later on in this same sutta, one of the kind of nice and little touching things later on in the sutta is where the Buddha, just before he's about to pass away, he says to Ananda, Chunda, he may feel regret that I died just after eating his meal. Yeah? So go back to him and tell him, no, this is one of those great merits you can do in life, is to give a Buddha the last meal before his final passing away. It's one of the best things you can do. It's one of those beautiful little things where this greatest spiritual teachers in the world actually thinks about individuals, yeah, makes sure that they are okay and that they are looked after. And to me, obviously, if Chunda had given him poisonous food, that would have been very important. But if you have given the Buddha poisonous food, you probably feel pretty bad anyway, regardless. So I think that advice actually makes more sense, or more is more kind of interesting, if the Chunda gave him ordinary food, and then the Buddha still said that. To me, that still is a preferable reading. Because Chunda might still have been worried. Yeah, you gave him ordinary food, it was fine, but still he might have been concerned about that. Anyway, we'll come back to that later on when we get to that particular point in the sutta. Okay. So, he gets sick. Bloody diarrhea, sharp pains, as if he were about to die. And then he says to Ananda, let's go to Kusinara, which is obviously where he is going to pass away. And then we have this little verse, this little verses that you find in the Mahaparibbana Sutta, which probably were added by later generations of monks. Having eaten Chunda's meal, this I have heard. That confirms the fact that this is a later generations. He suffered a grave illness, painful, deathly or death-like, from eating a meal of pig's delight. Grave illness assailed the teacher. Having purged, the Lord then said, now I'll go to Kusinara town. Then, turning aside from the road, the Lord went to the foot of a tree and said, come, Ananda, fold a robe in four for me. I am tired and want to sit down. Very good, Lord, said Ananda, and did so. The Lord sat down on the prepared seat and said, Ananda, bring me some water. I am thirsty and want to drink. So, just very briefly, so we see the Buddha obviously getting very, very weak towards the end here, so he needs to kind of rest. And maybe the idea of the pig's delight is one way of explaining why the Buddha needed to rest so much. They're always looking for reasons for this, that kind of, because the Buddha is supposed to be somewhat better than other people. So that's why they're probably looking for these kind of reasons. So he needs to rest, and we see it here, we see it later again. And of course, and then he needs something to drink, especially if he had been sick, that would have been make a lot of sense. And then Ananda replies, Lord, 500 carts have passed this way. The water is churned up by their wheels and is not good. It is dirty and disturbed. But Lord, the river Kakutta nearby has clean water, pleasant, cool, pure, with beautiful banks, delightful. There the Lord shall drink the water and cool his limbs. A second time the Lord said, Ananda, bring me some water. Ananda replied as before. A third time the Lord said, Ananda, bring me some water. I'm thirsty and want to drink. Very good, Lord, said Ananda, and taking his bowl, he went to the stream. And in India, always when you say something three times, that means you are serious about it. So this is the third time. That's why you go for refuge three times. If you only go for refuge once, it means that you're half-hearted or a third-hearted, perhaps. If you do twice, two-third-hearted. So here, same thing again, three times. And that stream, whose water had been churned up by the wheels and was not good, dirty and disturbed, as Ananda approached it, began to flow pure, bright and unsullied. And the Venerable Ananda thought, wonderful, marvelous are the Tathagatas, the Buddha's great and mighty powers. This water was churned up by the wheels, and at my approach it flows pure, bright, and unsullied. He took water in his bowl, brought it to the Lord, and told him of his thought, saying, may the Lord drink the water, may the welfare drink. And the Lord drank the water. More miracles. Yeah, suddenly the water was pure. So, is this actually what happened? And how? There is no evidence anywhere in the suttas of these kind of things even being possible. Yeah, if the water is dirty, is it possible to clear it up like that? It is not kind of part of the typical, powers of a Buddha described anywhere else. Maybe it is possible. I don't know. I don't know if it's possible. But even if it is possible, these things are not the sort of things that the Buddha is described as doing really anywhere. He's not really described as performing these kind of supernormal powers and things anywhere in the suttas. I am always suspicious when I see these things, and I personally don't find it all that inspiring, actually. And again, the way to what to do in these kind of situations, if you have doubts about something, is to compare it to the other versions of this sutta. And in one of the other versions, what happens there is that as soon as the Buddha asks Ananda to go down and get some water, Ananda says yes. He doesn't say no, he says yes straight away. He goes down and gets the water. The water is dirty, still dirty, because you still had all the carts going through it. He brings it back to the Buddha, and the Buddha just uses it to wash. He doesn't use it to drink at all. And then later on, when it gets to the Kakuta River, like Ananda says here, then that is where they drink, because that's where the water is cleaner. So again, it is kind of useful to look at these differences. I think it is very likely that some of these extra little kind of special effects, if you like, they have been sort of been added later on, precisely because of people being a bit overzealous about lifting up the Buddha, making something special out of him. And I think that's quite likely what has happened in this situation. A lot of the other things that are here is actually exactly the same. The story also does change a little bit. It has different sequences and things. But a lot of the little details are the same throughout. Not some of these more miraculous and supernormal things are not actually the same. So again, it's good to remember that, just to know what to focus on in these things. It's kind of strange. You wonder why it is even there, that little passage, apart from the fact that it's supposed to show some kind of special power. It's a little bit... doesn't seem all that to add very much information. Yeah, there was some water there, and they drank, and yes, and then they kind of carried on. But probably this next part here, which is the reason why this was added. So, at that moment, Pukkusa, the Malian, a pupil of Alara Kalama, was going along the main road from Kushinara to Pava. In other words, he was coming in the opposite direction to the Buddha. Seeing the Lord sitting under a tree, he went over, saluted him, and sat down to one side. Then he said, it is wonderful, Lord, it is marvelous how calm these wanderers are. So here we have, this is interesting in many ways. This is, I don't think Pukkusa the Malian is talked about anywhere else, but Alara Kalama is quite well known. Yeah, Alara Kalama is one of the two first teachers of the Buddha to be before his awakening. There's two teachers that he had learned meditation from. One was Alara Kalama, and the other one was Uddaka Ramaputta, that you find in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 26, Middle Length Sayings number 26, the Noble Search Sutta. You find the story in there about what happened. And it's interesting that here you have... these teachers are talked about again, yeah? So these are not, obviously, these are very likely to have been historical teachers at that time. So the teachers that the Buddha had before his awakening are actually talked about here. Uddhakaramputta is also talked about elsewhere. So you have these teachers being well known in northern India, northeastern India at that time, which is interesting because it gives it more a little bit more historical reality. And here, this person, he is a disciple of Alara Kalama, just as the Buddha had been at one point. Yeah. So again, this is also kind of interesting here. Anyway, so now he's saying it is marvelous how calm these wanderers are. He's referring to Alara Kalama, and this is what he has to say about him. Once Lord Alara Kalama was going along the main road, and turning aside, he went and sat down under a nearby tree to take his, not his siesta, that is wrong. It is the Pali word is Diva Vihara, which means like the day's abiding, quite literally. It means like the meditation for the day. Siesta means like you're snoozing off. Isn't that what it means? Yeah, you're kind of sleeping. It's a Spanish word, which means that's what you do but after having an enormous Spanish lunch, and then you have a siesta afterwards. I think that's what it usually means. That is not what it means. There, the good Maurice Walsh has gone a little bit astray, unfortunately. Yeah. Anyway, and 500 carts went rumbling by very close to him. A man who was walking along behind them came to Alara Kalama and said, "Lord, did you see 500 carts go by?" "No, friend, I did not." "But didn't you hear them, Lord?" "No, friend, I did not." "Well, were you asleep, Lord?" "No, friend, I was not asleep." "Then, Lord, were you conscious?" "Yes, friend." "So, Lord, being conscious and awake, you neither saw nor heard 500 carts passing close by you, even though your outer robe was bespattered with dust?" "That is so, friend." Yeah, so the point here, of course, is that he's supposed to have very good meditation. It wasn't a siesta at all. It was the meditation experience, as I mentioned. The meditation was so profound that even though there were 500 carts coming so close that his robe was full of dust as a consequence, still, he didn't hear anything, no idea what was going on. Which is kind of nice. Nothing that out of the ordinary when you think about it. When we teach samadhi in Buddhism, of course, as soon as you enter any really deep state of samadhi, you don't hear anything. Yeah? So 500 carts would come by and it wouldn't be such a big deal. So it's a little bit strange that they're making so much out of it. But also, in one way, also quite interesting, and I'll mention that in a second, why that is the case. And that man thought, "It is wonderful, it is marvelous, these wanderers are so calm that though conscious and awake, a man neither saw nor heard 500 carts passing close by." And he went away praising Alara Kalama's lofty powers. And then the Buddha responds, and this is even also a little bit strange. "Well, Pukkusaha, what do you think? What do you consider is more difficult to do or attain? To, while conscious and awake, not to see and hear 500 carts passing nearby, or, while conscious and awake, not to see and hear anything when the storm is streaming down and splashing the rain gods," he says, but it really is just a word for the kind of a storm happening, "and when lightning is flashing and thunder crashing. Lord, how can one compare not seeing or hearing 500 cards with that, or even 6, 7, 8, 900, or 1,000, or hundreds of thousands of cards to that? To see or hear nothing when such a storm rages is more difficult. Once, Pukkusa, when I was staying at Atuma, at the threshing floor, a storm was raging, lightning flashing and thunder crashing, and two farmers, brothers, and four oxen were killed. And a lot of people went out of Atuma to where the two brothers and the four oxen were killed. And Pukkusa, I had at that time gone out of the door of the threshing floor and was walking up and down outside. And a man from the crowd came to me, saluted me, and stood to one side. And I said to him, 'Friend, Why are all these people gathered here? Lord, there has been a great storm, and two farmers, brothers, and four oxen have been killed. But you, Lord, where have you been? I've been right here, friend. But what did you see, Lord? I saw nothing, friend. But what did you hear, Lord? I heard nothing, friend. Were you sleeping, Lord? I was not sleeping, friend. Then, Lord, were you conscious? Yes, friend. So, Lord, being conscious and awake, you neither saw nor heard the great rainfall and floods and the thunder and the lightning? That is so, friend. And Pukusa, that man, thought, it is wonderful, it is marvelous. These wanderers are so calm that they neither see nor hear when the storms come crashing around, the lightning flashes and the thunder crashes, proclaiming my lofty powers. He saluted me, passed me to the right, or circumambulated me with the right side towards me, and departed. So here we have this meditation competition going on. Who has the deepest meditation? And it is, you know, from the point of view of the Buddha's teaching, really, these are, all of these things are already let go of when you enter a state of jhana. You cannot really hear anything anymore. The deeper that jhana state is, the less chances there is that you will be able to hear anything. First jhana, maybe, second jhana, no chance. So, from the Buddha's point of view, the Buddha's point of view, there's nothing really astonishing about this at all. So it is more like just a way of speaking to lay people who don't understand meditation fully what profound meditation is about. That is how I think you need to read this. And of course, the problem is that when you read the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 26, the Buddha to be, he was the disciple of Alara Kalama at that time, and they both had meditation to the same level. So I think this here may be kind of setting the record straight a little bit, because in that sutta, the Buddha doesn't really go any further than Alara Kalama, but here we kind of set the record straight and to make clear that the Buddha actually did have deeper meditation than Alara Kalama. Perhaps that is what it is about. I don't know. It is just a supposition. There must be a reason why it is in there. And maybe there were some people who were having doubts or whatever, and then this is a result of that doubt, perhaps, by later editors of the sutta. But the other thing that is sort of interesting with this is that in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Noble Search, Majjhima Nikaya 26, when the Buddha to be, he is taught by Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta, it says in there that he attains the state of nothingness under Alara Kalama. And there's a lot of discussion what that state of nothingness actually means, because in later in Buddhism, that state of nothingness is one of the most profound states of meditation you can have. It is the third of the arupa, or the formless attainments. Very, very profound. And the question then is, did Alara Kalama have that such profound meditation, or did he not? And this is an interesting question, because as we, you know, those of you who know the sutta as well, you will know that later on the Buddha reflects back on the time when he was a child, when he had his meditation experience. It does not reflect at the time when he was under these teachers. So is it possible that that nothingness could have meant something less than the immaterial attainments, the very profound meditation? And this here, perhaps, I'm just saying perhaps, points to the idea that Alara Kalama did not have those incredibly profound meditation experiences, and that the idea of nothingness in that sutta actually may refer to a more shallow kind of meditation, whereby you don't hear 500 karts. I guess that's a kind of a nothingness. If you don't hear 500 karts, kind of a useful kind of nothingness. So nothingness may have had a slightly different meaning. There was still very empty, but maybe not quite as empty as the Buddha's later classification of states of samadhi, if you wish. Just a hypothesis. It's impossible to really prove these things, but it's kind of interesting to read the various suttas in terms of each other, and you start to kind of untangle some of these slightly uncertain things that we are always being discussed, and nobody's really sure what is going on, and we can untangle perhaps some of those loose ends in the suttas. untangle a loose end. Well, I don't know if that's kind of the right metaphor, but whatever. There's something here. It's supposed to tie up the loose ends. But anyway, so that is what that is about, I think, and the reason why that is in there. Again, slightly strange. Yeah, this is the thing when we come to suttas that are more legendary in content, a little bit hagiographical. Hagiographical being like a biography of a saint. It all becomes a little bit supernatural as a consequence and strange sometimes. So then it goes on. At this, Pukusa the Mala said, "Lord, I reject the lofty powers of Alara Kalama as if they were blown away by a mighty wind or carried off by the swift stream or river. Excellent, Lord, excellent. It is as if someone were to set up what had been knocked down or to point out the way to one that had got lost or to bring an oil lamp into a dark place so that those with eyes could see what was there. Just so the Blessed Lord has expounded the Dhamma in various ways. And I, Lord, go for refuge to the Blessed Lord, to the Dhamma, and to the Sangha. May the Blessed Lord accept me from this day forth as a lay follower as long as life shall last." So, interesting how you kind of change your allegiance very quickly. Yeah, you hear a story and then you think, yeah, that's much better, and you kind of become a Buddhist as a consequence. I think today people need a bit more persuasion than that usually to become Buddhists. But I think India has always been a very religious or spiritual society where people always had a kind of spiritual gurus and things already. They weren't just a bunch of atheists like people are today. And so it was kind of probably easier to kind of change your allegiance from one to another one. Yeah, when you heard something, it was kind of probably more natural. But these days, people have been Buddhist for 20 years. Yeah, and then you ask them, "Are you Buddhist?" "Oh no, I'm not really a Buddhist." They kind of been there. I've read all the suttas. They've been on 1,000 meditation retreats. They have keep the 5 precepts. But are you a Buddhist? "Oh no, I'm not a Buddhist." It's as if they're a little bit afraid of labels, that sort of thing. Yeah. So it's a very different culture you can see from that. Then Pukusa said to one man, "Go and fetch me 2 fine sets of robes of gold-colored cloth, burnished and ready to wear." "Yes, Lord," the man replied, and he did so. And Pukusa offered the robes to the Lord, saying, "Here, Lord, are 2 fine sets of robes of cloth, of gold-colored cloth." Or maybe cloth of gold, not sure whether that means gold spun into it or just gold-colored. "May the Blessed Lord be gracious, graciously pleased to accept them." "Well then, Pukusa, clothe me in one set and Ananda in the other." "Very good, Lord," said Pukusa, and he did so. Then the Lord instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted Pukusa the Malian with a talk on Dhamma. Then Pukusa rose from his seat, saluted or bowed down to the Lord, circumambulated him with the right side towards him, and departed. Soon after Pukusa had gone, Ananda, having arranged one set of golden robes on the body of the Lord, observed that against the Lord's body it appeared dulled. And he said, "It is wonderful, Lord, it is marvelous how clear and bright the Lord's skin appears. It looks even brighter than the golden robes in which it is clothed." "Just so, Ananda, there are 2 occasions on which the Tathagata's skin appears especially clear and bright. Which are they? One is the night in which the Tathagata gains supreme awakening. The other is the night when he attains the Nibbana element without remainder at his final passing away." When he dies, in other words. "On these 2 occasions, the Tathagata's skin appears especially clear and bright." So here we are obviously coming very close to the passing away of the Buddha, Yeah, he's almost saying so himself, the skin is appearing bright on the night that is going to pass away. It means that he's going to pass away tonight. So probably this now, Ananda is getting a bit worried perhaps, and like a bit kind of shaky, seeing that the Buddha's end is coming very, very close. But interesting here, this idea of the Buddha's skin becoming so bright and pure that it is more golden than the gold-colored cloth. This is another little kind of miracle. Not many people have gold-colored skin. It's kind of unusual. What are we to make of this? And I think there's two things, kind of slightly contradictory things maybe, that can be said about this. And the first one, which I just mentioned before, is that it is on record in other suttas, other discourses, that the Buddha did get old like everyone else. Yeah, it specifically says that his skin was no longer as shiny and gold-colored as it was before. He was getting more dull and perhaps a bit darker, and I don't know what. So already his natural, bright skin was kind of already deteriorating. That is specifically said in other suttas as he was getting very old towards the end of his life, directly contradicting this, almost in exact opposition. And again, we need to remember that the Mahapanibbana Sutta is more a eulogy, more a hagiography, more a legend and myth than often it is history. And as I think I would rather read some of these other suttas where the Buddha talks about his own body and says, well, that's what you can expect. That's what it says in the other suttas. That's what you can expect. You're getting older. This is what happens when you get older. It happens to everyone. There's no exception. Just because you are the Buddha, still have a human body, still happens to us. To him, rather. And all of these things help us, in my opinion, to relate to the Buddha as a human being. Always the danger with hagiography, and I think this is such an important point to make, all the danger with too much hagiography, it creates too much distance between us and the Buddha, and then his message is less urgent, less immediate, less feeling of being a disciple of the Buddha, because he feels slightly alien the more of these kind of things that you actually have about him. So I prefer that idea, that the Buddha is aging just like everyone else, and I take that to be the main message of the suttas. But on the other hand, it is also very interesting, if we go back to this sutta I've been talking about just before, the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Noble Search, Majjhima Nikaya 26, where the Buddha's enlightenment is described how he then has these teachers that we're just talking about. Then he awakens, and then after his awakening, he meets this Ajivaka. Ajivaka was another sect in India at that time, a certain group of people, religious people, and they also had a following. And this Ajivaka, his name was Upaka. And Upaka, he's the first person to see the Buddha after the Buddha's awakening. Yeah, some people say it's Balika and Tapusa, which is found in the Vinayapitaka. This sutta says it's Upaka, so it's a little bit contradictory perhaps. Anyway, so Upaka sees the Buddha. Wow! Gee, your faculties are so pure. Your skin is so bright. What happened to you? Yeah, what's going on? You kind of look slightly otherworldly. Are you for real? You look real. And so he looks at the Buddha. And so what we are seeing here is that just after your awakening, you have a purity about yourself that is really astonishing. It's almost tangible. When people see you, it's like, whoa, yeah, look at this person. There's something very peaceful, very calm. Your eyes, your hearing, your faculty, everything are incredibly clear. And your skin also becomes clarified at the same time. Yeah, and it kind of makes sense, that because we know that the mind has a certain effect on the body, we know that that is basically true, and the clarification of the skin also, to my mind, it actually makes sense that should be the case, because there is some effect of the mind on the body. So that is what we have at the time of awakening. So it seems to me that that would also have been a little bit of an effect at the time of the Buddha's passing away as well, because now he was coming to the end of his life. Finally, he was going to lay down the burden once and for all, and he was probably looking forward to that. One of the few people in the world who is looking forward to their own death, Because finally, yay, I'm going to die. Whoa, so happy here. Out of here. End of all suffering here. That's kind of how the Buddha sees things. And it's very upside down compared to how most people see these things. So it is possible. At the same time, he didn't really have any special meditation attainments at this stage. He was more traveling and he was more sick. So he wouldn't have had perhaps the same boost as he had at his awakening experience. But maybe there was a little bit of that. So these are kind of just, I'm just pointing out two slightly countervailing factors that may have had an effect on the Buddha's physical appearance. But basically, I think the main message in the suttas, as I see it, is that the Buddha is getting old, and he is really just one of us, and he's very similar to how we become old. The Buddha is pretty much exactly the same. And I think it is very useful to point that out, because it creates that connection between us and the Buddha, which is so important not to lose sight of and to have. Anyway, so this is the pretty much the last thing that happens. Actually, let me just read this next paragraph, and then we can stop after that little verse there. Tonight, Ananda, in the last watch, in other words, the last third of the night, in the sal grove of the Malas near Kusinara, between two sal trees, the Tathagata's final passing will take place. And now, Ananda, let us go to the river Kakuta. Very good, Lord, said Ananda. And then we have this tiny little verse. Two golden robes were Pukusa's offering, brighter shone the teacher's body than its dress. Not sure about those little verses, whether they add very much, but anyway, there you are. So I'm going to stop there, because I have to go down to Perth Cathedral, actually. There's a kind of a multi-faith service down there, and Buddhists have been invited as well. But before I go, is there any comments or questions or anything? Everyone is happy here. Are you happy with this? Yeah? Okay, good. I'm glad you're happy. Well, we have some questions from outside. Yeah? Okay, very good. We will take those. Excellent. Thank you. Okay. Okay, very good. Okay, someone from Malaysia. Remember I was asking about the person who was knowledgeable about the the Dhamma, the words, and someone has actually sent that through. So that's very handy. So the four are the Bahusutta. Actually, you have spelled it wrong. Bahusutta has only got one T, just to let you know. Agata Agama, which means that you have received the Agama. The Agama is like the Nikayas. The Agama is the word that is used in Sanskrit. It also occurs occasionally in the Pali Suttas. Then you have the Dhammadhara, you have the Vinayadhara, and the Matikadhara. Matikam is like a list of headings, like a contents list almost, and sometimes it seems to refer to the Patimokkha. So very good. Thank you very much for doing that. So that is outlines. It's probably, what are the outlines? Matikadhara, yes, expert on the Patimokkha, could also be expert on other matikas. Matikas being lists, headings, content lists. So it could be things like the Sangiti Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, the last sutta in here, or the Dasotra Sutta, but actually the Sotra Sutta is the last one. Sangiti Sutta, which is the chanting together, is the second last one. They are like Matika Suttas, because they are like headings almost. If you go to the Abhidhamma, you have the headings at the beginning, the Matikas, Abhidhamma Matikas at the beginning here. So they are like content lists almost. Patimokkha might be considered that. Outlines would be the same thing, would be the same word, it would be another translation for Matika. So good, thank you Malaysia for sending that through. It's very handy. I can just sit here and it comes to me, just sent over the internet. Don't even have to have my own Pali book here. Really, really good. This is the advantage of modern technology here. Then we have the second question from the Netherlands. What is the morale of this story? Oh, the morale of this story. The morale, the main, There's lots of morals in this story. There's so many morals, I don't have time to talk about them all because it's going to take a long time. But one of the main morals is the impermanence of all things. Yeah, this is the kind of the, in a sense, the most disturbing impermanence in Buddhism, the impermanence of the Buddha himself. He has to pass away. And then how do we deal with that? And the reason why people grieve and they are sad and they lament when anyone passes away, especially when the Buddha passes away, because we haven't really taken on board the idea of impermanence, of unreliability, of things being out of control yet. Yeah, so this is one of the very big and important things that go through the whole Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the idea of impermanence and the problem with that and how that causes so much suffering, and then how we need to reflect on that to be able to straighten out our view, to align our view with how the world actually is. And then we suffer much less, because then we realize actually we shouldn't have a refuge in the world outside, we should find the refuge inside, in our meditation practice, by living well, by doing the right thing. That is where you find a refuge. Then you have a real refuge. The world outside is inherently out of control. That is problematic. So this is one of the important morals of this whole story. But there are lots of sub-points, full of sub-points. Yeah? And this is kind of the beauty of the Mahaparinibbana story, is that it is about how the Buddha gives us these little teachings on how the Sangha, how the Buddhist dispensation, how the lay people, how everyone is supposed to carry on after he passes away. What are the final instructions? What is the teachings really about? How do we collect the suttas together? How do we live without the master? It is important to remember that when someone like the Buddha, a towering figure, yeah, someone who has laid down all the laws, all the rules, spoken pretty much all the suttas, when someone like that dies, the greatest spiritual master in human history, I think it's from my point of view, there's absolutely no doubt about that. Someone like that dies, it leaves an incredible vacuum, like this gaping hole in the Buddhist dispensation. Yeah, and imagine what you feel like when someone like that dies. And very difficult. Yeah, imagine one day when Ajahn Brahm dies in the Buddhist society. Yeah, it would be pretty kind of, what are we going to do now? Help, Ajahn Brahm is no longer here. Yeah, be ready for that, because one day it's going to happen. Yeah, and this is kind of, this is much worse, obviously, when the Buddha passes away here. So a lot of what this is about, getting people ready to be able to deal with that situation when it happens, and all the teachings, that little teachings that come in with that. But also, it is interesting because it shows us some of the evolution of Buddhism after the Buddha passes away, how the legend of the Buddha gradually starts to grow out, start to appear in the, even in the other suttas that are not as legendary as this one. It is even more naturalistic the way it is explained. This sutta, we're starting to see more supernormal things. So we start to see that transformation from suttas that are very naturalistic and very natural to stories that are getting more and more difficult to relate to, because they are more and more miraculous, if you like, or over the top, or florid, and all of these kind of things. So in brief for you about the morale of this story, but you have to read the whole Mahaparinibbana story to understand it fully. Okay, I better go now for my next appointment. We shall continue, so I hope to see you again next time. Don't know when that will be, by the way. It could be a while, but anyway, I hope to see you then. Let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.